Okay, it's time for us to get caught up with what's happening with the church in the East. We left off our look at the Nestorian church in the East with the Mongols. And you may remember that while the Mongols started out generally favorable to Christianity, when later Mongol Khans became Muslims, they embarked on a campaign to eradicate the gospel from their lands. It pretty much rang the death knell to and for the church in the East, which for centuries boasted far more numbers and covered a lot more geographic area than the church that lay to their west. That's both the Eastern Orthodox and the Roman Catholic churches. Now, since that may confuse newer listeners, let me clarify. The church in the East is not the Eastern Orthodox Church that's headquartered at Constantinople. It's not the Greek Orthodox Church or its close cousin, the Russian Orthodox Church. No, the church in the East or of the East was also known as the Nestorian Church. It looked to Nestorius, a one-time bishop of Constantinople, who had officially been labeled a heretic, but who became the patriarch of a wide-ranging church movement that eventually reached all the way to Japan. Well, today, Nestorianism is officially recognized as a heresy in its view on the nature of Christ. It's doubtful that what came to be known as Nestorianism was actually taught by Nestorius and by what was believed by the Christians of the church in the East for the first few decades after its separation from Orthodoxy. It would probably be best if we reckon them as genuine believers, legitimate followers of Jesus, though there are definite differences between what we believe and practice today and what they did, just as there'd be, well, a difference between us and most believers of medieval Europe. In any case, the once vibrant church in the East came to a virtual end with the Mongols. It wasn't until the 16th century that the faith began a renewed mission to the East, and this time it was by a concerted effort of Europeans. It came because of the expansion of the Portuguese and Spanish empires in the 16th and 17th centuries, and then to Dutch, English, French, and Danish traders in the 18th and 19th centuries. Even before the Jesuit order was recognized by Rome, its founder, Ignatius Loyola, was aware of the need for an able overseer of missions to the East. Though he was loath to lose his beloved assistant, in 1540, Loyola sent his ablest lieutenant and closest friend, Francis Xavier, to the Portuguese colony of Goa in India. Now, Xavier remains one of the greatest of all Christian missionaries. He possessed an immensely attractive personality and really a Paul-like determination to preach the gospel where Christ had not been named. Xavier moved from Goa to the fishermen of the Coromandel coast of India, where he baptized thousands and engaged in discipleship, though by his own admission, his command of the language was marginal. He visited Sri Lanka from 1541 to 45 and Indonesia for 2 years before entering Japan in 1549. He established a Jesuit mission there and had two Christian books translated into the Japanese language. Exposure to Japan with its at that time, deep respect for all things Chinese convinced him to do whatever it took to enter China. He was poised to do so, and then he died in 1552. Alessandro Valignano was born to Italian nobility and obtained a doctorate of law at the University of Padua. But a profound religious experience that we'd have to call a dramatic, genuine conversion hijacked his career path and set him on mission. He became a Jesuit in 1566 because they were about the only ones at that time who were doing missions. He was appointed visitor to the Eastern Mission in 1573 and sailed to Goa from Lisbon in 1574. After a period of study in Macau, he came to the conclusion that the church was going about the task of spreading the faith to new people all wrong. He was determined to take the gospel into China, but realized that meant that he would need to learn the language and customs. The Chinese were an ancient and proud race. They weren't going to be wowed by relatively uneducated and backward Europeans, regardless of how superior those Europeans might think they were. Valignano knew that learning Chinese would open a door for the gospel. He vehemently opposed the conquistador approach to China and Japan that both Portugal and Spain had used in their conquest of the Philippines. He made three trips to Japan from 1578 to 1603. Like Francis Xavier, Valignano was convinced of China's importance as a mission field, but failed to make it there. That would be left for two other Jesuits who carefully followed his mission's philosophy. Their names were Michel Ruggieri and Matteo Ricci. They entered China in 1583. Ruggieri and Ricci, along with those who went after them, earned the deep respect of the Chinese, not least for their mathematical and astronomical abilities, but because of their high regard for Chinese culture. Ruggieri, who was a lawyer from Italy, he worked with Ricci in Portuguese Macau before moving to the mainland. Together, they produced a Portuguese-Chinese dictionary. And Ruggieri later composed the first Chinese Catholic catechism. He was proficient enough in the language to even compose Chinese poetry. Ricci, an outstanding intellectual, mastered the Confucian classics and came to believe that the kind of grounding that he'd received in the works of Thomas Aquinas and his use of Aristotle was compatible with the moral ideals that had been set out by Confucius. Ricci's work of 1603, which was titled The Meaning of the Lord of Heaven, adopted this approach in reaching out to the Chinese literati, among whom he was deeply admired. Ricci believed that participation by Chinese Christians in ancestor rites, it didn't compromise their faith. And we'd probably have to disagree with him on that one. From 1600, Ricci was allowed to live in Beijing, and that was remarkable for any foreigner. His successors, Ferdinand Verbiest and Charles von Bell, were also greatly admired by the Chinese and were given official positions by the first Qing emperor in the late 17th century. They carried such influence that they were able to secure positions of honor for other missionaries. It's a tragedy that after the combined influence of Villagnano's policies were followed through with such success by Ruggieri, Ricci, and their fellow Jesuits, it was eventually overturned in Rome. The so-called rites controversy at the opening of the 18th century hinged on how far the honoring of ancestors was a civil versus a religious act. Rome ruled against the Villagnano's position, saying that Chinese Christians were engaging in superstitious and unbiblical acts. This led immediately to alienation of the Jesuits and the loss of all the goodwill that they had earned. Christianity became viewed as a religion of foreigners, a huge no-no for the Chinese. Now, the issues raised by the rites controversy, they weren't laid to rest until 1939, when Catholics were finally allowed to take part in ancestral veneration, and the rites were accepted as mere civil demonstrations of honor, which had lost any of their earlier pagan associations. In India, another Jesuit apostle of accommodation, Robert de Nobili, he immersed himself in the philosophy and culture of Hinduism as a way to bridge to the people of India and to share the gospel with them. Like Villagnano, the Italian De Nobili, he was determined to detach himself from the European models of Christianity and incarnationally manifest the gospel in India. He succeeded and was able to see several high-caste Brahmins become Christians. But his methods raised controversy among his superiors, and for a time, he was forbidden to baptize. In Vietnam in the 17th century, Jesuit pioneer Alexander de Rhodes followed the same accommodationist policy and advocated ordaining national clergy to carry on the work of evangelism and church planting. This was unheard of and got him into major trouble with his superiors. You can lead people to faith all day long, but you can't make them priests. Priests come from Europe, for goodness sake. I mean, everybody knows that. I mean, just imagine what a nightmare you would be making if you started ordaining Vietnamese or Indian or Chinese or Japanese as priests. I mean, come on, let's not get carried away. De Rhodes knew that it was right to ordain nationals and to disregard the ban that had been placed on him, eventually leading to his expulsion from the Jesuits. Nevertheless, by 1640, there were some 100,000 Vietnamese Christians. After Francis Xavier departed, Japan enjoyed a period of great progress. Valignano was deeply impressed with the quality of Christianity that he found there. By 1583, there were 200 churches and 150,000 Christians. In one town south of Kyoto, there were 8,000 baptized in 1579. But there was a sharp change in attitude by Chinese political authorities later in the 16th century due to a fiercely resurgent nationalism. In 1614, all Jesuits were expelled. Persecution broke out for the 300,000 Japanese Christians in a population of 20 million. Christians were crucified in Nagasaki. There were more mass executions in 1622. The policy was pursued with great savagery between 1627 and 34 and resulted in many, what came to be known as hidden Christians, whom 19th century missionaries found retained their knowledge of many of the symbols of the Christian faith when Japan opened 2 centuries later. Now, despite the eventual persecution of Christians in Japan in the later 16th and early 17th centuries, Andrew Ross, a Protestant, judged that the Jesuit mission in Japan to be the most successful approach to a sophisticated society since the conversion of the Roman Empire. We're going to continue our look at the eastward expansion of Christianity in the 16th and 17th centuries next time as we consider how the Dutch and the English began to reach the East.